Hello, 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 hello. I think we're going to have a fun day today, for a number of different reasons. The first one, I just want to get started with, as soon as you're ready to go with this camera.
The camera's ready to go.
Just press it once.
So, a couple of things have been of interest since we last gathered. On Tuesday, in the afternoon, Alex Lee and Diane Lucas and Mary Will participated in a very interesting interview of a guy named Father Albert, who was visiting from Jamaica, along with Ken Reeves, who's the mayor of Cambridge. And we recorded this in the Berkman Center. And it's cool. I mean, we edited it up. Jason Crow is here today. I'm totally excited. This is Cambridge Community Television. That's what Jason represents. And we're going to be talking today about video, how you get it up, how you get it out, how you make it. And it's just a fun thing to do. So it happened that on Thursday, Fern and I were doing our first meeting of a reading group that David was present for. This was a group in which we're talking about the Tao Te Ching as the start of an odyssey of emotions. And I had asked for AV to cover it, but it turned out that my request was too late. Sometimes that happens with me. And they weren't ready with the personnel. But what they did do is they gave us this camera. And so we wound up, during the course of the reading group, just passing the camera around. And we wound up making our own video, which I then have been editing. Fern and I are now in the midst of editing. Dean, I hope, is going to come over this evening and give us a tutorial on iMovie. It's fun. And so I thought, well, here we have this camera, and it's, you know, holidays, so there's the extension school is not covering it. And we should start passing the camera around here if we could, at least if that's okay with people. Yeah. So the idea basically with one of these cameras is you focus on things that are interesting. Right? And your idea of interest is perfectly okay. The fact is, it's good. But don't get stuck in the idea that you have to get a whole lot into your shot. Because when you look at it on a little screen, a whole lot of stuff just looks like a bunch of dots. So ultimately, the payoff with video is the in-type close-up shot right at the moment when they hit the agony quotient. That's like it. Now, I gotta get my... Ben, would you pass the camera to somebody else and see if you could hook my laptop up, because I wanted to show a slide and I've got them behind. So I actually wanted to introduce Jason and CCTV by making some connections that go way back with me. First, I wanted to show you a slide of the 1998 Internet and Society Conference that the Berkman Center did at Harvard. This was a conference that was basically the launch of Berkman Center. But there in the upper right on the front page is a picture of Fred Friendly. Now, Fred had actually died some years before, but he's a guy that I recommend you just pay enough attention to so you get a picture of this guy. You've seen him in a very odd representation of him. If you watch the movie about Edward R. Murrow just recently, what's the name? Good Night, Good Luck. Fred Friendly was Murrow's producer. And in the part, as played in the film, he's kind of a low-key, cool guy. But that was apparently because, who made that movie?
Well, it was
George Clooney. George Clooney. Yeah. Wait a minute. Go. I don't know what that's about. Yeah, so George Clooney in this film had a problem, because if he played Fred Friendly the way Fred Friendly really was, he would have upstaged all of the other actors that were his cast, basically. So he recast Fred Friendly into this kind of intelligent but somewhat mousy character, which was like not Fred. Fred was a guy who would, he would just let it out. Whoa, it's like came like a hurricane. I met him because after he got fired by CBS over things that the film in some way depicted, he became a leader at the Ford Foundation and was instrumental in starting public broadcasting. And then after he got finished with that, or actually next stage anyway, he connected with Harvard Law School and the Socratic method as we were practicing it then in the form of Arthur Miller and myself, and started this series of programs called Fred Friendly Seminars. And the thing that was exciting about Fred was here was a guy who was totally into media. I mean, media was what he thought about. And he got excited because he saw the potential for somehow teaching and working with dispute resolution in an interesting and entertaining way, as a potential way of putting the media to work on problems that he really cared about. And it was a good idea. In some way, I feel myself as if having been a moderator for Fred in the media environment in which he had that insight, I'm now at the stage of being the Fred. You know, it's like I'm the next, I'm up a generation now. And it's up a generation in terms of the media environment. And so this ability of using a camera, just being able to put it into a map, iMovie, move it around, and make it into a QuickTime, when it's there, is just amazing. So, the first thing I wanted to do, can you get it up on the screen? Oh, I want to do it on the map. You're absolutely right.
It's not even this computer.
Not again. Okay, so there's a few things I want to show you. But the immediate excitement of today is actually kind of getting into the video. So, Jason, tell us who you are. Who are you?
Who am I? I'm Jason Crowe, the Access Coordinator at Cambridge Community Television. Has anybody seen Cambridge Community Television? Anybody? What have you seen on Cambridge Community Television?
Like like a show called Be Live or something, and they interview me from the community.
Yeah, so there's Be Live, where people like get on the set and do their thing. What else?
Saw the 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, we've got a few of those. Anything else?
I don't know the name of the show, but that woman who's always got these people interviewing people. She's always got this like strong slant on it. I don't remember.
So let's see. I've already heard it. We got conspiracy theories, a strong slant on something. I don't know what the hell she's talking about. We've got V-Live, which is the hot set. There's a lot of stuff going on at CCTV, and I'm kind of here, hopefully, to work with Professor Nesson and kind of talk about video and community media and how that relates to what you guys are doing. Just a real quick background on me. It's kind of hard to see those colors, but I went to film school at a small state university in Michigan and in the Czech Republic at the FAMU. And then when I graduated, I started working at a community media center. And then I went and started doing work for the United Nations, setting up media centers in Ethiopia and Uganda. So I've only been doing this for like 6 or 7 years professionally, but it's been a wild ride, let me tell you. Because as you've already said, there's a lot of interesting characters in community television. If you notice, I wanted to show everyone my avatar before we got started. It's more of a grassroots avatar, I guess you could say. And my friend made it, so I thought you might enjoy seeing my avatar, which actually really isn't an avatar at all, but just a drawing of myself. So the way that at least that I kind of thought about talking about this stuff is, I'll show you right here. Let's see. So I want to talk real quick about the history, some policy stuff, some intellectual property issues with community media and community television, talk about some media consolidation issues that media in general has been going through. And talk about media reform, and then kind of talk about all that in the context of creating public opinion. So in influencing the way that people like you and me and like my parents think about issues that are important to the way that our democracy works. So what I first want to do, however, is take a look at this video, because there's nothing like community media better than video, right? So let's take a look at this real quick. Now, what this is from, that's actually my niece. What this video I'm about to show you is from Current.tv, which is a brand new television station that's kind of taking community media and community television to a whole new level. So to get us kicked off here, I wanted to show this video. And what I want you to pay attention to is how it's constructed. So you all are hopefully going to be real fancy lawyers someday. And so what I was hoping to do is kind of take a look at this and dissect it, and also just kind of see a cool video. So this is Current TV. This is a journalist, if you want to define it that way, who submitted a piece on waterboarding. And this is kind of the version that was put on the television station. And we'll take a real quick look at it. Once I get audio. No audio? Oh, I know what's going to happen. I needed it. Okay. Thank you.
basically what we're doing is I'm going to be waterboarding. Okay, and waterboarding is a technique that falls under the umbrella of coercive interrogation where they simulate drowning an individual in order to make them talk. I underwent waterboarding in my training when I was in the service, and I'm going to undergo it again today to demonstrate the types of techniques that have been used to interrogate suspects. I'm doing this because I think it's important to put this in the court of public opinion. The fundamental tension here, the root of the issue, is this tension between how do we balance the need for information security with the morality of using interrogation techniques that could constitute torture. I contracted a group of professional, experienced Army SEER, ex-SEER instructors to waterboard me for $1,000. No, that's not true. Contracted them for $800. Originally they asked $1,000, and I just couldn't bear the thought of paying somebody $1,000 to torture me. So I weaseled them down to $800, and I'm sure I'll pay the price for that in about 5 minutes here. Hey, Mitch, can you do me one more favor? Can you just ask Mike where the nearest hospital is, like sort of mission planning, safety, and the route to the hospital? Just supposed to be perfectly safe, but in case anything goes wrong.
The person will lie back, making it so that their face is actually under their chest, and will, as through the questioning, will force water into a wet rag. Every time the person breathes in, essentially they're breathing in moisture, and it starts to create the sensation of drowning, suffocation, and then the panic sets in. You're looking at the average person probably lasting somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 minutes or so once it actually starts happening.
Would you have seen this type of video on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, or any other major news outlet, do you think? Hey, yeah.
Well, I could say no with some certainty because I actually know the guy who did that,
yeah.
Mike, the guy without his mask on, mm-hmm. the torture guy. Like, I know him, he's a friend of mine from Rhode Island. And I know for a fact that he's actually been trying to, like, he runs this service of, like, I don't run it, but he runs this service where he will provide, like, sort of almost, like, simulated, like, interrogation situations for, like, people who are interested or to, like, help train other groups or just for, like, thrill seekers who I guess are sick of like skydiving or whatever, but I know that he's actually been shopping around like certain programs and things to networks, and he's still in talks, but I know for a fact like the major networks are not really going for it.
Besides the fact that he's got a proprietary piece of good that he doesn't want to get out there in the public, like why wouldn't we see that on TV, on network television? Anybody?
Well, there are a couple things about the bid structure. I mean, first of all, I imagine that that sort of actually doing that to somebody would you'd get a hue and cry about it being troubling and disturbing and not the kind of thing you should show on TV and stuff like that. But secondly, also, it seemed like, and I kind of like this about the presentation, there was not a whole lot of quasi-objectiveness about it. And I think if you were to get such and we didn't see a whole lot of the interviews and things, but you know, he out and out calls it torture at the beginning, and the little introduction has the quotes from the famous torture memo and stuff. So it's clearly presenting a single point of view. It's more of an opinion kind of thing. You're not going to see that on major, on NBC or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's really kind of my whole point today, maybe, is that community media and independent media is this electronic green space that provides an outlet for people to have a dialogue about things in a way that I don't think could happen under a corporate media sort of structure, because though his friend is beholden to his own interests in making sure that his business prospers, I think they're actually more interested in, like the guy said, creating some sort of stir in the court of public opinion. So I got this quote here that last year, 2005, at the National Conference for Community Television Centers and Community Media Centers all over the country, this was kind of the quote that kind of stuck with me as we were getting ready to fight a whole legislative battle that's been going on for about a year and a half now. And it's, you can probably read it. The communications policy debate is about the nature of our democracy. It's about who gets to speak, for what price, and to whom. This is another thing that I thought I'd bring up in this class, because it's come up a few times, and it's what? I didn't even title it, because you all know. Yes, thank you. There's two perceptions of community media in America, and I'm gonna maybe posit or say that one of the sides of the public perception is that community television, independent media, is a lot about Wayne's World and crazy church ladies, incessant boring talk shows, lunch menus, bulletin boards. Has anybody seen their hometown community television station? What's on there?
Lunch menus.
High school sports.
High school sports.
I had a friend when I was in high school who had a talk show, and he was kind of chunky, and it involved him dancing around in a jock strap for a lot of time.
Would you call that technically inept?
I would call it psychologically scarring. It was a little Wayne's World and a little crazy church lady. I mean, it was all of those things. It was definitely not. It wasn't something you would ever see on network TV. It wasn't something you should see on network.
So I was having a conversation with the director of the International Institute for Capacity Building in Africa, who wanted to bring community media to all of Africa, and a lot of the meetings that I had with high-level officials in Ethiopia and Uganda and other places, I had to fight the public perception of what I did. And I still have to do it. Sometimes, when I go places, like I do a lot of college presentations for undergrads and stuff, and it takes a while for them to get over this public perception and kind of maybe take a glance at the perception that the professionals in the industry, some of them, kind of have about themselves, and kind of the sort of PR work that we might need to do to get to that point. And that's the community media actually has a federally has a federal mandate. We have legislation that harks back to like the 1927 Radio Act and then subsequent 1934 Telecommunications Act that was really interested in protecting electronic green space in America. And they were really nervous that if they just let all the corporations take over the radio spectrum at the time, it was just, we were gonna be screwed and it was just gonna all be, you know, commercials for whatever. But the other side of the Necker Cube perception is that there's fiber institutional networks in America in a lot of communities. Huge, dark pipe, like fat pipe that's just sitting dormant and was built because of the federal legislation that requires cable companies to get a contract with the city. And we'll get more into that. There's estimated 15,000 hours to 20,000 hours a week of local programming made. I think of community media as all about First Amendment speech. A lot of people, a lot of the things that we have to deal with are obscenity laws. Who decides what's obscene? By the way, the FCC, not in community media land, thank God. Anybody else?
Community norms.
The community norms, but who really decides? Oh, this is my law school question.
The jury?
the courts, exactly. A lot of times it doesn't get to a jury situation, but it gets to a judge. And like in Grand Rapids, if you check out Timothy B. Huffman versus People of the State of Michigan, you'll find Tim Huffman used his penis as a puppet. And penis puppetry in the UK is a high art.
What are you talking about? What kind of high art?
It's high art considered by some people. The norms of England, at least according to my wife who studied there and studied fine art, she says, I went and saw a penis puppet, and it was in a huge theater, and people paid like $25, you know, a pop to see it, or £25, and that was art. And so Timothy Huffman, actually, the First Amendment defense was actually thrown out immediately. Possibly a conservative judge in Midwestern Grand Rapids, Michigan, saw the case and was like, forget it. You're not even going to try First Amendment. This is not even going to work. So I see citizen journalists. I see wireless mesh networks. Other people see international information communication technologies development using community media to develop. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a question before we just move on. We looked at these two different perceptions of community media. And it seems to me that the public perception has a substantial grain of truth to it in terms of my personal experience when I tune into community media. So if we take as a baseline that this is valuable for this green space to exist, my question is, what is the missing piece? Why is the stuff that's on the community media stations not very interesting a lot of the time? And then why is it that when we start looking at YouTube, we suddenly are discovering that there's tons of citizen-produced media that actually is very interesting?
That's a very good question. And I got to tell you, if I knew the answer to that question, I would be in Washington, D.C. right now talking to Senator Ted Stevens saying, like, look it. Like, this is why it's important to maintain this green space.
But what do you think are the elements that make a successful community media production?
We're going to get there, actually. And what I think about that, Rebecca, is there's a lot of things that make a successful community production, but the answer that I usually give to people when they ask that question, because it's a very valid question, is how much like meaningful, relevant, interesting content is on regular television. Now, it's my humble opinion.
Wait. Why would you ask a question like that?
Because I was getting to something like...
We know what's on regular TV.
Okay.
But we also know what's on community TV. And the question's a very good one. Here, we're able to make, you're able to come in and show totally dynamite stuff. I mean, my answer, why don't we see that? Because when it gets to the torture scene, people would turn it off. There was a point during that show, I don't know, did any of you come to a point during that video where you had an instinct to turn it off?
Yeah.
But not everything interesting has to also include disturbing video.
Well, suppose you take that as a guiding principle. Suppose you say, all right, we're looking for why it is that there's nothing interesting on community television. And we've discovered that if you put up stuff that makes people turn the station off, that's not going to make it. And then Becca asks, well, doesn't that leave still an amazing void to be filled with genuinely interesting video?
Well, my answer to that would be there's about 2% of regular television that's any good, if you ask me, and there's about 2% of community media that's any good. And YouTube actually is a tool to rise the best stuff to the top. Community media has never figured that out. And the internet is pretty new, not only to media in general, like high-speed internet, especially in America, we're like 16th, depending on who you talk to, with broadband penetration. Especially in America, the ability to watch TV on the internet hasn't been around that long. So I guess my answer to that would be there is good stuff. It's not being aggregated. It's not being put to the front, and that's why you don't see it. And it also has to do with its infrastructure, I think, too. Community television stations are inherently local, and they're local by physical demand. The only place you can see Cambridge Community Television is in Cambridge. However, the internet has made it possible for it to reach outside of that. But we've never had to really search within ourselves until now, until our funding's threatened, and we need to find a new way of doing business that we are starting to discover, and we're starting to discover that we needed to aggregate a long time ago and rise the best stuff to the top to create that demand for our product.
Yeah. Well, on that point, how do you decide, you know, on community television, like what goes in and what doesn't go in? Because it seems just the nature of the medium is that it's supposed to be inclusive and that, you know, anyone in the community should be able to have their voice up there. And, you know, the fact that, you know, having someone at the top saying, you know, this is good, this is crap, this is out, seems to be kind of antithetical to like what I think of community television as being, why, which is why it's something that, you know, does get used by a lot of cranks.
Yeah. Well, the first answer to that support question was that we don't censor and we don't aggregate and we don't particularly care most of the time. With 17,000 hours of programming going on our three channels at Cambridge Community Television every year, and like six staff members to do it, we just physically can't watch the stuff. So what current TV has done and what YouTube has done is has distributed the amount of work that it would take to aggregate popular and or interesting content and make it easy to share. Cable is an analog medium, which I haven't talked about this yet, but television at its core, at its code layer, is has changed in the last like 10 years. Analog signals are cable signals. It's a wave. It's magnetic. It's not ones and zeros. And so that code was restricted to localities. Now that the code has changed and we're creating everything digital, video is now pixels, and pixels turn into JPEGs, and 30 JPEGs a second create a frame, and 30 frames per second. 30 frames per second, each frame is a JPEG. So our code layer has changed, and thus the way that we deal with the rest of it is changing too. It's offering like a whole new host of difficulties. I mean, board of directors everywhere are crapping their pants because of the internet. Because all the policies they've ever written have been about locally produced stuff that they can have more control over the content. But as soon as, like on BeLive, you can go in there and roll in the internet. And that's like huge. And do you have the right to do that? I mean, yeah, go ahead, Ben.
But is there a reason that that somehow doesn't qualify as being community television? It seems to me that one of the aspects of community television is community members making a decision about what should be shown locally on their television stations, whether or not it's produced locally. So for instance, we have several at-large participants in this course who have arranged to show the lectures from this course on their community television stations in their hometowns, and it's not local to them.
Yep, so the hope is that we're serving community television stations will break out of this mold. And believe me, I've been talking about this for a while. We'll break out of that mold and serve two interest groups. One is a local interest group with local interest, and a local interest group with global interest. So that if I'm really interested in butterflies, and I find out that Rebecca Nessen here has made this awesome video on butterflies in Cambridge, and I live in California, all I gotta do is up, you know, get on TV and show her video and not have to deal with the policy constraints.
But you don't want to be worried about the content. You want to be worried about the method for aggregating the content.
Okay.
And would you then describe for folks your idea of bicycle and posse and how that fits into your thinking?
Sure. Okay, so what a few of us in the country have kind of deemed as important to the future of community media, because we're being threatened at all levels. There's state legislation, there's federal legislation, there's local courts, there's all kinds of ways that the powers that be are threatening local voices, and in the midst of that, there's been a group of I don't know how to describe them. There's been a group of us who have tried to think of new ways to share content. And the first kind of way I want to jump into this, because it gets really technical or really out there really quick, is that I want to start with what you know about, and that's like, who here reads blogs? Okay, who here like aggregates blogs with an RSS reader? Okay, a few less. Does anybody read any blogs to get their news? You know, not entertainment, let's say? A few. Okay, so.
Has everybody downloaded Democracy and put yourself in a position to take the feeds from our class? That's an RSS feed.
So there's people like Lisa Williams at Watertown, in Watertown, h2o.info, that has created what she calls a place blog that is starting to supplement what is traditionally a cable television function. And what she actually does is she takes a TiVo, records a public access selectman, or I think it's city council meeting, only goes to the part she wants to see because she can fast forward and rewind, exports that chunk of video, puts it on a blog, analyzes it, writes about it, and then has a readership of X amount of people that get their local news from h2o.info. And so there was a group of us that kind of looked at these models of like h2otown.info. She's starting a new blog, Place Blogger, that's going to aggregate those type of blogs. It's not up yet. I think it's actually a partnership with the Bertman Center. But what we thought is, okay, here's a little snapshot of the internet. This company, Lumeta, sent out a message to the North American registered internet, and this is what they got. And the different colors represent who owns the network. And we thought, okay, if here's the network, and here's these new tools, blogging, RSS, aggregators, all that stuff, how can we harness that stuff to distribute our content? So we decided to, wow, this is really, let me change the colors of these. Is that, can you see those red ones? It's going to be hard for me to change the color. Yeah, you can see. We looked at different online outlets. We looked at R Media, which is...
We'll post your slides. So.
Okay. We looked at rmedia.org, which is a grassroots media thing started by, I think, the funding through like Rooster Kale, which... anyways, it's this big, huge, almost unlimited repository for videos and audio. And we're like, okay, we'll start with like rmedia and archive.org. Well, it's a free service, and everyone uses it. And it sometimes can get slow because of that. And it's a great thing. It's hopefully going to be around for a long time. But that didn't work. Then blit.tv came about, and we're like, okay, well, that's a great place to find sort of content that's more geared towards the community. It's like YouTube, but it's not YouTube. And we looked at Google Video. We looked at other sharing sources. And we just couldn't find anything that fit our needs. So we took these technologies, BitTorrent, content management systems, open source, really simple syndication, and we kind of adhered ourselves to the ideals of the open source movement ideology, where if you're going to create something, you create it and then give it back, you give that intellectual property back to the community. And we thought that was kind of a cool community media thing to do. Compression rates have gotten a lot better for video. And there's a lot of projects out there like mine. And one is D-Production is working to launch a new community-driven public access center in Denver.
Tell us function.
Function?
What are you trying to do? All right, you're a coder, and you're going to code.
Okay.
But what is it you're trying to accomplish?
All right, so what we're trying to do is allow anybody in America and in the world, basically, we've done this with people who have high-speed internet connections, anybody who's got the tools can log into dev.digitalbicycle.org and they can sign up for their own blog and essentially they become their own television station. And they get their own RSS channel that you can subscribe to. You get your own ability to do groups. You get your own ability to do like little mailing lists. You get your own ability to have other people subscribe. You can ask other people to subscribe. And you basically create your own channel. And it's kind of like a blog on steroids. Because you post, you have your video file, and you process it, and you create this torrent file, it's called. And then you just upload the torrent file to your blog, and then other people who are subscribing to it get that file. That file points to media, wherever it's stored, and then sucks the media in. And we're working with Possum, which is the other part of this. So there's the web component. And this gets really technical real fast, which is why I don't usually jump right into it. But there's the web component, which is Digital Bicycle. And then there's this other component, which is called Possum, the Project for Open Source Media, yes?
Why don't you just use YouTube? Is it because what's the difference between uploading the community media onto YouTube versus Digital Bicycle? I mean, it's the file size, right? They're broadcast quality videos, right?
Yeah. Dean knows all about this, actually. He could probably present it better than I could. They're huge files. Like, if you want to put stuff on television, it's huge files. So what we're trying to do is connect the internet stuff with television. That's the big like key here, that's the big missing link, is that there's 1,300 centers in America getting federally mandated funding, they have like 24 hours of possible programming to put up every day, there's all this media being created on the internet, let's connect that with television. And we use BitTorrent to share those large video files.
Can I ask a couple questions about this?
So you're saying that I could create a television station, but actually, do you mean to say that it's that I probably wouldn't want to because I don't have this broadcast quality video, that it would be somebody who has this kind of broadcast quality video to distribute who would do this, like CCTV would have a blog like this?
No.
But I really have one.
You could have one. You could decide that you want your own channel, and instead of exporting your movie out of your editor in as a small movie, little internet movie, you just export it as its regular size.
So I would use it for videos that I created myself and that I recorded off of public access stations.
Yeah. Mainly you created yourself. Because when you shoot video, you're shooting for the size of television. It's only after you process it that it becomes the size for internet, which is a lot smaller.
So I may be just being too repetitive on this question, but it seems to me like the problem goes the other way with community media. There's a question of how you guys could get more content that would be interesting, rather than how you could distribute a lot of content that people may or may not be interested in.
Well, the idea is that that along with all of the ways that people are sharing media, that all they have to do is do one extra click and it's shared to a community media network that is broadcast quality. Like if you submit to Current TV, you're still submitting to a for-profit venture that has all these stipulations and regulations and all that stuff.
But we're getting hung up is like back with what Art brought up before. I mean, suppose his hometown has a community media station, then they do this digital bicycle thing, and now they've got a lot of video of some chunky high school student dancing around in a jockstrap. Maybe that's like not what people want to see.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I doubt that stuff would get distributed. I think it's really easy to get hung up on the content, the poor content that we're familiar with, and forget about perhaps the content that you're not familiar with that is good.
So I agree with that. There's a couple of things that seem to stop me from finding that content on Cambridge Community Television.
Yeah.
One of them is this very weird thing where there's a lack of a listing, so I can't know when a program I want to see is going to be on, so I can't plan for it. And the other one is...
Just step on that one.
Okay.
I wrote to CCTV and asked them, how come you can't get a listing? Because I have an ambition that our program will be up on CCTV and I'd like somebody to be able to know about it. They said it's because they're not permitted to by
Comcast.
So I then wrote to the general counsel of Comcast and said, I request. And I've gotten back one email saying it would be referred to a local person. I've then written them back saying I haven't heard from any local person yet. And I got a second email saying I hear from a local person. And that's where it stands at the moment. So if one were looking for any kind of clinical project to get involved with, that involve one of the most serious limitations on quality in our Cambridge community television, we would go to work on Comcast to get that listed. It seems like just arbitrary discrimination, just a way of holding down any form of interesting community media. You just have to come across it. So that's just a thought.
So the second question is, isn't there some way to put in some kind of filtering or something that does this process of letting you know which things most people think are in the best 2%? You have three stations, maybe one of them could be a premier station or something like that. What is going on to make that happen?
Well, what you're addressing is the way that community television was built. It was built so locally that there hasn't been that sort of collaboration. There is Alliance for Community Media that represents, according to them, 3,000 television stations. But due to the code layer, It's been really difficult up until recently. The analog situation, for one, you have to share content. In the past, you have to put it in an envelope and mail it. Someone's got to get in, sign the form, blah, blah, blah. What Digital Bicycle is trying to do is take advantage of the new code layer and say, okay, all you got to do is when you export, just make sure you export this type of file. If you've already got, you know, your blog set up, you just publish that thing, it's available to anyone that can access the internet, including television
stations.
Just
locally in Cambridge. I mean, you know, you've got your
livelihood
associated with doing Cambridge Community Television. It would be good to have the best stuff you could have up on there,
Yeah. Even
just drawn from your own local audience. So what I'm wondering is how you attempt to do that, or how you're planning to change the way you do that, so that I start to find that I want to tune in to CCTV when I turn on the television, because it's better than all the rest of that crap on the network television.
Well, I imagine if I do figure that out, I'll be in a big race.
She made a suggestion earlier on that sounded very plausible to me, and it just went right by it, but I've been thinking about it ever since you made it.
Sure.
What happens if some Cambridge resident requests time on Cambridge Community Television to do a program on the best of the net?
Yeah, they could.
They could.
Yeah. They could do best of CCTV.
Best of CCTV. You could have a best of.
Yeah.
And if you had a listing, then you'd be in business.
Yeah. Well, we have a listing under, I can't get my internet for some reason to work right now, but under programs is a listing of all the shows, and it's updated through a live subscription. It's exported out of our database, it goes into there, it's updated continually, and so that's there. But think about our audience. I mean, the one thing that no one's brought up yet is the fact that who has internet? Rich people! Like, people that don't usually have a voice in media. Who's community television trying to serve? Everyone, but also we try and help encourage people who are marginalized in society to have a larger voice. So I guess my kind of response maybe to some of this is, if you forget the analog code layer and you disregard the cable network, then you're forgetting a whole segment of society, including seniors, low-income people, who only can afford, let's say, the utility of a cable television station. So if you look at all the elements, and you think about all the elements, I think you can, the projects that have been proposed, and he's got a question, I think. Do you want to say something?
You can finish.
The projects that have been proposed by myself and this collaborative group called pegspace.org try and address all of those issues, because it's a pretty complicated mess to think about serving the wealthy, top 15% that have high speed internet, that have high speed downloads, that can't upload this stuff, and at the same time serving seniors who maybe their only source of information and entertainment is their cable television. Yep.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying with regard to that, and so there are some people who can't afford internet or haven't adapted to technology yet, but in 20 years, the way things are going, it's probably going to be just like TV with the internet. So is there really any long-term future for the community television project in general, or is it just going to be in 20 years everyone will have access to these internet tools, and they'll be widely affordable, and they'll post whatever movie they want?
I want to take a try.
Okay, go ahead.
We have to bring this to a close here.
Yeah.
It's really eye-opening to go down to CCTV. It's right down Central Square, one stop, and it really, it's worth a visit. What you see there is a school. You see people learning to do media, and you see people of different levels learning to do media. And what was so exciting to me, and it's in a sense the point of my asking about Bicycle Possible. What Jason's doing is he's working at the code layer for integrating the media so that it is more or less possible for anybody with a TV set to receive through their typical TV method of absorbing media, stuff that's off the internet, aggregating off the internet, delivering to TV. And it's equally possible, and it's really the,
Okay. Gotcha.
That's one.
Are you going to need the audio to make sure you got
it? No, I got the audio. Here. I've got 1 minute. This is the point of last week. I felt that the David Laser talk didn't focus as well as I wanted to have focused. The focus is right in this graph. This is the picture of the net. It's closer than the one that he showed you with, huge. But the question is, who are you? Who are we? And the point is, we're one of these dots here. And we can be a red one. We can be a colored one. We can light it up. That's like the basic idea. And that's Fred Friendly. It's his idea that good ideas could light this medium up. And I sent email, and so will leave you, I think, on the way out with, where did it go? Here. This is from Glenn Brown. Glenn Brown is one of the first of our Berkman Fellows, led Creative Commons for 3 years and now is at Google. And just send me this in email. Have I got it in? Oh, I haven't got the sound.
You muted earlier, so if you're unmuted, you probably get it.
No? All right, well, I sent you this in the email, and it's definitely worth your taking a look at. It's yet again an example of something that somebody made, just like we can now make things and out to go. Yes? Oh, I'm totally confused.
But we probably have this workshop.
Oh, my goodness. I got totally confused.
But can I just introduce that?
Yes, please.
So I just wanted to say something before we move to the second phase of this class today. Jason's going to actually attempt to give us a little lesson on how one produces something that is quality television content. So ideally the kind of thing that would be sticky when somebody flipped across it on CCTV and would make them want to stay there and watch more of it. And the reason that we're doing this workshop in this class is that the next step for your projects in this course, after you develop your idea and figure out what your argument's going to be, is to express it in some kind of cyber medium. And that could include something like television or internet video, something in which you actually try to make a video production. It could also include a blog or a wiki or who knows what else. But so this is the beginning of a series of workshops that we're going to be having in this class, in which we attempt to give you the very beginnings of the skills that you would need in order to choose that this is the technology you'd like to use for your project and to get started figuring out how to do it. And then it's going to be up to you to take the next steps to get all the way to making the project, hopefully with the help and support of the people in your group. So with that, I'll hand it over to Jason.
Great, so yeah, I just wanted to maybe cap that conversation, respond lastly to his question, and then move right into production. Because actually my life has been an echo cube of talking about those issues and then dealing with the actual producing content. But to respond to your question, there's a really smart guy that I saw at a conference named Andrew Blau, who I think said it really well about the role of independent media practitioners or professionals or television stations or PBS in the next 20 years, and that was to become a trusted aggregator. That's not my words, that's maybe not even his, but that was what we talked about. We ended up talking about that for, especially CCTV, we've talked about it a lot, is how to become a trusted aggregator in your community. With the morass of information, the morass of video out there, how do you get trust, and how do you find the right write that out. So that's what I think we'll be doing in 20 years, is just sifting through all the stuff and hopefully doing it well. But what I guess some of you might end up doing is actually making a video. Has anybody thought that they might make a video? Anybody? Raise your hand. 1, 2, 3. It's hard to see it behind the screen. Video is a trade and a craft like lots of other things, and it's got a process. And if you do the process right, you'll end up probably getting better results. And it can become sticky or viral, as Rebecca said, and you can end up being aggregated to the top. But there's a few things that you should keep in mind. And at Cambridge Community Television, we actually teach those things. So another component of community television, besides the electronic green space, is the training facilities that Charlie kind of alluded to about. You walk into CCTV, and since I run the training program, it's kind of near and dear to my heart. You walk into CCTV almost any night, and there'll be 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 classes going, 3 classes in a meeting, some resource center in the community is using our space. And it's a community center, and it's a community media center, but the most important part of that is the community that comes in and uses it. But when you're there, you can learn, you can take any of our classes once you become a member. Membership is required. You can take any of our classes to learn things about, like, pre-production. Videos, you can make video in kind of 3 phases: pre-production, production, and post-production. It's kind of like figuring out what you're going to do, doing it, and then editing it to make sure it's really what you want to say and how you want to say it. And really, if you can break it down into its component parts, pre-production or planning is probably, I would say, the most important. A lot of people love to just grab the equipment and run with it, but I would say you should step back a second, leave the equipment at home for a while, and do lots of planning. So figuring out what it is you're going to say, just like writing an essay, figure out who your audience is, what you're going to say, how you're going to say it, and figure out whether you want to do like documentary or fiction or a mixture of both, or you know, who's going to be in it, how long it's going to take. So we already talked about this a little bit, but nowadays video is made.
Wait a minute. If you're not going to go 1, 2, 3, okay, then I'm going to disagree right now.
Okay, what do you disagree with?
What you just said.
Okay.
Planning is all that's important. It's like you're going to plan yourself to death, you're not going to do it. It's like if you want to, suppose this class decided it was going to make a video of this class, how would we do it? We couldn't, because this is the class. We'd have to have a planning class first, right? You can't do it. It's the other way around. It's the editing, it's the aggregating that's by far the most important. So I invited you here today,
yep,
Becca with me, appreciating the idea, and we saw the work of Beyond Broadcast with this conference that was here that I've described to you before, and the potential of it. Right? So there was some pre-planning. Right? Now we have the execution, and we've got various media recording. But then there's the post-production. That's the part that's really hard. That's the part where you take something that's got a lot of mess in it and clean it up in some way. And you're running a school down there of community people who are learning how to do this.
Yep.
Is there any way we can get together?
Yeah.
May I interject something? As one who's knee-deep in post-production for exactly the kind of project you're talking about, I want to side with Jason, because if there had been more planning before the class even started, the post-production would be so much easier than it is right now. I don't think that pre-production is everything, but going in with the attitude of like,
it's 40%.
That's it.
Well, I have to say that it's an interesting take on it, because after making films for a few years, the tools dissolve away, and all you're left with is the content that you have, and the editing becomes a little more fluid, the shooting's fluid, and the equipment's fluid, and the technical stuff of it, and like piecing it together in a way, like that kind of like dissolves away, and what rises to the top is like the story that you've planned out and the way that you've structured it. Now, you can get stuck in the pre-planning process, and it can be a big ball and chain, it can be really crappy, and you can sit and talk all day, and that's no fun. So what's great about CCTV is that a lot of our classes are geared for what Professor Ness is talking about, and that's just to like go in, learn a lot of stuff really fast, get access to the equipment, go do it, get critiques on it, and then air it, and then do it all over again. So we try and combine that process of good pre-planning, actual production. If you look at it on a timeline basis too, not to belabor this point, a lot of times the actual having a camera part of your production is like a day or 2 days. The actual turning the camera on and shooting is like an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. But editing on the other hand is like hours. You have a 5-minute video, you're going to edit for like 15 hours, probably minimum. And that's if you want to do like pretty good editing. Now, if you have a large amount of video that you've already shot, then just like sifting through all that crap is going to take forever too. So you want to capture what you need, you want to be ready to only get what you need, and then like he said, you want to plan ahead so that when you get in the edit room, you're not pulling your hair out. Yes?
Okay, for somebody like me who doesn't know anything about editing, if you just want to do something really simple,
yeah,
a really simple 5-minute video, would it really take 15 hours? Like, why do you have to edit it? It's just like you just videotape it one person.
Well, I would suggest that the torture video was, at its core, a really simple video. The only complexity of that video, I thought, necessarily was maybe the opening with the newspapers, but I could teach you how to do that in like 15 minutes. But it was basically just like a medium shot interview, right? And another shot of them doing the torture, and they just put them together. Did anybody see anything else in that video? It's very, very powerful the way they did it, and it worked really well. But essentially, all they did is they took the A-roll, as we call it, which is the interviewing, the talking, and they had some A-roll, talking. They cut to B-roll, which was the torture sequence, and then back to A-roll, which is the interview, and back and forth. So really, to do something simple, you can do something incredibly simple that's incredibly powerful. And that's kind of, the power of documentaries, that for someone who has no experience, if you learn these simple things that CCTV can teach you about like your bread and butter shot, which is the medium shot, about thinking of what type of B-roll you would want and actually gathering it, using the internet to download pictures. Like I use Creative Commons filtering on Flickr to do a lot of B-roll stuff, and you can do that too. You want to think about a lot of these things, but let's kind of move in to the nuts and bolts of it. What Dean's got back there is the setup that you're going to want to use if you have video, or what he has down here, and that is you're going to need a video camera. You need a tripod. You're going to want a microphone. You might want lights, but you don't have to have them. These are lights. They're not the best lights for video. You want to make sure you have headphones, batteries, maybe a notebook to actually write something down. And then in the end, you're going to need an edit suite. And so what Dean's doing is he's actually capturing the essential parts of the video. He's got what? He's got video and he's got audio. And that's what you need to get started. And at that point, what you do is you connect to your editor, which can be one of these. I see a lot of Macintoshes out there. iMovie comes free with your laptop. So maybe if you're going to get into video productions groups and you want to edit at Heartness or the Commons, you could make sure that someone in your group's got a Macintosh computer.
I should say also that there's a full video editing station in the HLS Computer Labs, which is free for all of your use. And if you need for more, there's also one at the Extension School Computer Labs that we can arrange for you to use. And that has, both of those have really fancy editing software on them.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know how deep we want to get into video, but you know, some things to think about are your locations. You want to do maybe pre-interviews, like for instance, the torture guy. To go back to him, he didn't just show up on the doorstep of the torturers. He went and talked to them. He knew what they were going to say. He knew how they were going to say it. He maybe even asked them to say it in a certain way.
Jason, can I just the number one thing is not the video, unless you're making an art film. The number one thing is the audio. If the audio is no good, video can't fix it. If the audio is good, any number of video things can go along with the audio. So, like, the limitations largely, the spaces that we're in here, are the microphone limitations in terms of getting actual, real quality material. It's not the video. The other thing I'd say is, this little camera right here, this ordinary little camcorder, with the approach that Diane was suggesting, that is, set it up, do it. If you've got good audio and you're just willing to, I actually like handheld better than tripod. I find it more interesting. I like movement in scenes rather than just straightforward stuff. But don't be intimidated by the difficulty of it. It's simply not that difficult. And this iMovie thing, I started, I don't know, 2 days ago playing with it. And I, if I could have got my stuff up there, I'd be showing you iMovie at this point. It's actually a tremendous amount of fun. And you realize it's a very direct form of a new pen. It's like a way of speaking in the medium. The video that Jason showed us is obviously an incredible, powerful example of someone using the space for rhetorical purposes to make an argument. So it's there for us.
Yeah, so here's a production by a 15-year-old girl named Lexi something, I can't pronounce her last name. And this was like after having, you know, spent a good amount of time in training, but I think she gets her point across for
1918. The Red Sox happily led Boston to their fifth World Series victory, the most of any clubhouse in their time. Since then, it's been nothing but agony for Red Sox fans. All thanks to what some people call the curse of the Great Bambino.
I think the plays, when the games themselves, are not ones that believe in curses. I don't think that curse ever existed.
I just believe that it's what people are created in their minds as an excuse for why the Red Sox choked so many times.
Some superstitious Red Sox fans believe in this curse. And all started when the owner of the Red Sox sold Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees.
Yeah, so how is this constructed? What's the video?
A lot of it is stills.
Yeah, it's all just stills, right? You can just download them from the internet. You should have the right to show them most of the time. But if you don't, then you'll graduate in a little while. You can defend yourself. But the other thing is that she does what Charlie was saying. She does it really well as far as the audio goes. How does she sound? She sounds like she's in the room.
Also known as Boston's Rattles.
And she uses really simple music.
18. The Red Sox happily led Boston to their fifth World Series victory, the most of any clubhouse in their time.
What's that sound? What's that? Cheering, right? It's what we call gnat sound, or a sound that you would get in a field. And what does that evoke? Right? It evokes the baseball stadium. So I think she did what Professor Nesson here is kind of trying to bring out in this presentation on making video, is that with a little bit of planning and some good foresight, you can take these very simple elements of still pictures, video, and audio being very, very important in that equation, and tell a good story.
So Jay, say a word in a few minutes that we do have left about the legal plight of CCTV. Talk to us as lawyers, potential lawyers. What is your legal problem? What is your legislative problem? What would you love to have an army of lawyers at your behest for?
Wow. I need my PowerPoint for that. Now, starting in 2005, AT&T, former SBC, and Verizon got together, and they started lobbying the powers that be in Congress, and they've got all this legislation introduced at state levels and at federal levels, and it's really quite freaky, actually, just how this like multi-pronged attack on community television there has been in the last year. And it's AstroTurf groups. Does everyone know what that is?
No.
An AstroTurf group is a group that's created by a for-profit corporation. And they create an organization, a 501c3, that actually has the same interests as the corporation. So we've been battling, like I said, state legislation. We've been battling federal legislation. Right now, thank goodness, network neutrality as an issue has stalled the Senate legislation that's in process right now. And because of the grassroots movement of MoveOn.org, SaveAccess.org, and people like me and you who have spoke up in the media, there's been this big backlash against getting rid of what some people call network neutrality issues. And what they're trying to do right now is they're trying to rewrite the 1996 Telecom Act. It's 2006, it's 10 years later. They're trying to rewrite this act, and what they're trying to do in the rewriting process is diminish, and if you talk to some cable operators or cable administrators in towns, they're trying to get rid of all the public interest obligations on television providers so that AT&T and Verizon can jump into the video providing market and do whatever the hell they want. Now, that's not my opinion. My opinion is that they're going to do whatever the hell they want anyways. But the legislative battle that we're in right now is to, where is it? To fight this legislation, I'll give you, the one thing that we had on our side is that network neutrality as an issue has been very difficult for legislators to legislate upon. So there's been one stream of thought that says we need network neutrality provisions in this new legislation.
Why are you against network? Give us the baseline and what is the network neutrality going to change?
Well, here's the,
what's the threat that you're under?
Well, the threat that we're under is that they're going to take away our funding. I mean, that, like, in one sentence, the legislation takes away like anywhere from 65% to 85% of our funding, and television is an expensive business. That's like,
take away the requirements of the companies to carry your content?
It takes away, we get 5% of gross revenue of a cable company to run our station. And we also get channel capacity, among other things. And what it's going to do is take that 5% and diminish it to 1%.
But it's going to keep the obligation of them to carry your content.
If the cable company and Verizon and AT&T decide that that's what they want to do.
So it's now free for them to just say, sorry, we don't want community television anymore.
Yes, that's how we interpret the language that's in the bill. Now, we've had amendments for grandfather clauses, we've had amendments for do no harm, we've had amendments we've introduced a lot of this stuff, and all of it's been shot down. And what Senator Ted Stevens and
but just before you turn to that, Beth's question is my question as well.
Okay.
The thing that's exciting about CCTV is not that it has 5% rather than 1%.
Yep.
What's exciting about CCTV potentially is that you have 24/7 connection with the entire Cambridge community through three channels that are totally unused. So that there is a potential for reaching out to a community audience through an existing facility. And all that's actually required is the generation of genuinely interesting content and some method for aggregating. And Becca's question is that under threat?
Yes. I'm on the public policy work group for the Alliance for Community Media that works on this stuff. And I'm not the foremost expert on this, and I wish some of our lawyers were in here to say this. That's my caveat or my disclaimer. But as far as I understand, the interpretations that our lawyers have, that our policy people have, is that interpretations of the language in these bills will, in some instances, create a free-for-all. Now, you're talking about 50 states, all of them that have their own state legislation on top of this. So depending on how this all pans out in a conference, there could be amendments to override state legislation and screw us from a federal level. There could be amendments or things brought up in conference that say, that get rid of do no harm. So at the moment that Verizon or AT&T is able to enter the television providing market under different circumstances than the cable companies that already are here are under, there's going to possibly be a big litigation free-for-all where there's there's no level playing field. So the cable company says, oh wait, Verizon, they get to do this? Screw you, I'm pulling my plug.
All right, so here's the problem that I see.
Okay.
Community television right now just doesn't count for much. So the idea of going out with an argument, we've got to save community television. Who the hell watches it? You can't even get a listing. The only thing that's actually going to protect community media is a radical expansion of the quality of the media that it's conveying to people, so that it becomes a genuine asset to a community.
Yeah.
Well, and that seems not to be a matter just of fending off people in Washington. It seems like the ball game is actually some kind of strategy of organizing the production in a distributed environment of high quality media within the Cambridge environment or filtered by the Cambridge environment and out through Cambridge television, cable, bicycle, possum, boom, you're gone.
Yeah. Yep. I agree with that. I mean, a lot of the things that you said, I agree with. Some of them, I don't agree with, but I do think that the ball game. I mean, what we're looking at right now is like the ninth inning, in a lot of ways. And we forgot to build that momentum in the seventh inning. And we're tired. And there's a lot of big companies that are a lot more powerful than we are. And we're looking for a way through these new product, these new digital bicycle, Possum, deep production, mapping access. We're trying to figure that out right now. And that's the real challenge. But I do think there is good content, actually.
All right, thank you very much, Jason.
Yeah.
Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.